So, so we've been exploring the four Samagravastus, these means of unification, means of bringing people together. We've heard about the value of generosity and looking at what it is we can give, what stops us from giving. In a sense, what we value being given to ourselves and others. When we talked about loving speech, and particularly exploring these very interesting questions of what is what the importance of timeliness, when is the right time? There's a whole lifetimes of conversations about the timeliness of speech. It's one of my favourite topics of conversation. Spent hours talking about that with my teacher, and also the ethics of intention and effect. Then we had a kind of silent day, an opportunity to settle in to ourselves. And then yesterday, Kamadana was evoking, beneficial activity, and particularly the qualities that we can bring to the world. And that leaves us with exemplification, which, to put it most simply, is walking the talk. Yeah, walking the talk. So, we're going to talk a bit about that. We're going to talk a bit about what we most value. We're going to hear a bit about the value of excellence, the parable of a rain cloud, self-meta in our desire to grow, exemplification as empathy, and spiritually naked, but not physically. Yeah. And the richness of human lives. So just to give you that's some kind of thematic guide. So walking the talk. So cast our minds in our imaginations. It's 1999. I've got a lot more hair on my head and a bit more hair on my face. And I'm sitting in a field. And I'm sitting in a field with three other young, naive, idealistic people. We're all about 21 years old. And we're holding hands. We're holding hands with two objectively pretty beautiful women and one guy who I like. Not all of them, but we're sitting in a little circle holding hands. And without really talking about what we're going to do or how we're going to do it, we start to meditate. This is my first experience of meditation in my life. And it is made substantially more chaotic by the fact that we're sitting in the middle of Glastonbury Festival and there is a lot of noise, all kinds. Yeah. But nonetheless, there we are, we're holding hands, and I encounter the tension between my strong aspiration to project love into the universe, and particularly into the hands of the two young women who I'm holding hands with, and I experience the substantial degree of disconnect between what I would like to be happening in my mind and what is happening in my mind. At the time, I have no real... I'm well aware that that's what's happening, but I don't really have any words to explain that experience, and certainly not to them, because I deeply wish to be good or pure or positive, or however you want to frame that kind of sentiment. And basically, I don't last very long, so we probably do that for about 5 minutes before we give up and go do something else which involves intoxication. But that was quite, in a way, that was quite an important experience for me. What was important about it was probably the first time I ever tried to meditate. And what was really striking was the discomfort and the... pain is probably a bit too strong a word to use, but it's like a substantial level of kind of emotional discomfort between what I wanted to be happening and what was actually happening. I could not deny my experience. I was a maelstrom of messed up... 21-year-oldness, and I was not a radiant, the pillar of love and light into the universe. I could not deny that.
Yeah.
So some approximately 2,500 years before that, a young Buddha was in conversation with a king. Yeah. So they just, this is one of their first meetings. So this is King Bimbisara, who goes on to become one of the Buddha's closest friends. For those of us who were at Paramartha's talk at Sanghanite a few weeks ago, you remember that story about the king who'd killed his father. Yeah. So this is the father. Yeah. This is the father. So Bimbisara, he is a young kind of energetic king, and he's testing the Buddha out. He's checking the Buddha out. So the question he asks the Buddha is, he says, "So, Mr. Buddha, you think so you're so hot, you think you're so wise, you think you're so clever. You see those bunch of kind of scraggly, crazy-looking religious weirdos over there?" This is India 2,500 years ago. There's a high preponderance of scraggly, crazy-looking religious weirdos in those days. You know, you've got the guy who, you know, never walks around with his hand above his head for his whole life. You've got the guy who acts like he's a dog and lives like he's a dog. So you've got all these people walking past, quite extreme aspects of human behaviour. So are they the real deal? Are they spiritual? So a Buddha looks at the king, says, And he says, "That's hard to say. It's hard to say." And he goes along to say why it's hard to say. We'll come back to that aspect of the story later. "It's hard to say. I don't know." And the king says, "Oh, you are so wise. These scraggly, crazy-looking religious weirdos, they are my spies. And I've sent them abroad in my kingdom to find out what people really think. And now they are going back to my palace, and they shall be washed and bathed by my retinue of courtesans, and they shall enjoy the five strands of sense pleasure all night." So it's hard, isn't it? It's hard. It is hard. What is hard? Well, particularly, it is hard to... it's hard to grow. Like, life is hard, but let's be a bit more specific. It is hard to grow. It is hard to have an aspiration, have an ideal, and it is hard to move towards that. We all know that. Yeah, it's hard to walk our talk. So in my little group yesterday, I was recounting one of my little stories, so apologies to those of you who heard this before. So one of the reasons it's hard is because we experience a substantial discrepancy between what our mind is doing and what the world experiences. Yeah. So, let's do this first. So, the experience of fear, the experience of fear and the experience of courage. Yeah. So, I would seek to suggest that experiencing fear is a core human experience, or it's a core experience of living beings. So, we experience fear. And then sometimes we experience courage. And what's important about this is that those outside of us only perceive the courage. Yeah? They do not perceive the fear. Yeah? But we do. Yeah? We experience fear. And then sometimes we experience courage. And what this means is that it's very easy to over-identify or kind of prioritize, give, in my mind, unhelpful weight to the painful aspects of our minds and not sufficient weight to our external actions. Yeah. So courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is experiencing fear and then acting. Yeah. I think that's really, in a way, that's a crucial distinction. I suspect you could make that with other positive qualities, but courage, fear and courage seem the most obvious one. So we experience fear and sometimes we act with courage. Yeah. So the way I like to put this, as which some, if not quite a few of you will have heard before, is counting up and counting down. Yeah. So we count down. I'm acutely aware in my mind of all the moments of unhelpfulness, unkindness, lack of love, lack of awareness, lack of courage, lack of everything, all the positive qualities of understanding that you care to number. I am acutely aware of those because I notice them in my own mind. You do not. What you notice is the moments of courage, the moments of kindness, the moments of love. So this was brought acutely home to me when I'd spent a year living at Padmaloka, one of our retreat centres, and we were having this kind of rejoicing in merits thing with five or six of us, and we'd been there for a year. So, if you know that exercise the other day when we had people sort of saying, well, talking about our positive qualities for a couple of minutes, and some of you found that quite hard. So in this context, we're talking about people spending like half an hour collectively saying all of the things that they value about you. So Kemadana, I like this about you. Kemadana, I value that about you. Kemadana, I value this about you. And it's quite unrelenting. And when it was my turn to be rejoiced in, what I noticed was this voice in my mind going, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, 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 but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. And there was a particular point where one of my friends said, Dharmashalan, you are always available for me when I want to talk to you, and you will always listen to me. Yeah? And in my mind, I immediately had the incident yesterday, not quite yesterday, but for dramatic effect, like, you know, within the previous week, where I'd sat on my bed and I thought, I could go and see if my friend's okay. I can't be asked. I'm going to sit here and read my book instead. Yeah. I explicitly had that thought. He didn't know that. All he knew was the times when I had gone and said to him, oh, hey, how are you doing? What's up with you today? Counting up versus counting down. I have a strong conviction that if many of us, maybe even all of us, without denying, of course, it's not a case of denying those thoughts in our own minds, but just giving a bit more weight to how other people experience us, I suspect we'd all be happier people. And kind of associated with that is, and in a way, this is this thing of fear into courage. I think often, too often, we have what we identify as a negative quality over here, and we think it should be transformed into a positive quality over here, as like an opposite quality. Yeah. So again, speaking for myself, in my early years of practicing Buddhism, I often felt that I needed to stop being like a bouncy Labrador puppy who slurped over people and become kind of mindful and quiet. Yeah. That was, well, for you all know me, I find it difficult to be mindful and quiet now, 17 years later. It's like, at the time, that was a completely unreasonable request. But what was a reasonable request, or what was reasonable, was for me to transform that kind of bouncy, slurpy puppy into a quality of welcoming, like appropriate welcoming, openness and interest in other human beings. That was a move which was possible. I could do that. So that's walking the talk. It's hard, and one of the major reasons it's hard is because I think we have unreasonable expectations of what we can achieve. Yeah. Counting up versus counting down. Okay, what we most value. So this is a bit of... This is a bit of speculation here, so some of us you feel are completely free to disagree. Yeah. So what we most value. So I can easily experience life as a game, as a competition, and I am in competition with you. Yeah. And I am in competition to get the most points. Yeah. And what are the points? Well, the points are value, yeah, being value in some kind of abstract, separated category. So what this means is, let me give you an example. So I remember quite some years ago being at the ballet. I'd never been to the ballet before. I wasn't particularly enjoying myself, I must confess. And there was quite a group of us there. We were there as part of a Buddhist activity. And sitting directly behind us were a bunch of slightly giddy, excited 8-year-old ballet students. Yeah, And I don't know if they were having a good time, because it was a pretty weird ballet, but they had lots of sweets to help them get through their time. And they were kind of squinkle, squinkle, crunch, crunch. And what I noticed was that one of the more spiritual, aesthetically appreciative members of our little company was getting increasingly irritated with the noisy little kids. Yeah. And my psyche saw an immediate opportunity to get some points in the competition of life. Yeah, because I was definitely not winning on the aesthetic appreciation of ballet. But quick as a flash, I thought, aha, but in the being tolerant of noisy school kids competition, I can smash this guy out of the pool. Oh yeah, you'll think you're so spiritual and aesthetic, but you're getting really grumpy about these innocent little children having eating their sweets. I'm so equanimous, I'm so calm, I'm so beyond that. Yes. So that's what I mean by keeping score, having a sense of competition, this constant... And in a way, this is a genuine question to you. Do you experience this too? Do you experience this too? This constant, sometimes it's more or less of a, this constant kind of positioning, evaluating, oh, where am I? How do I score? How much does this person value this? How much is this quality of mine worth in contradistinction to that quality of somebody else over there? Yeah. It's delightful. It's wonderful. It is a incredible opportunity for humility. Yeah. So, not so long ago, we had Kula Jardini's Leaving View, which many of us here went to, and that is a particularly fine opportunity to experience, just in a way, the humiliation of that desire to keep count. So basically, this woman who's here at the moment, but actually she's moving, and basically we spent an hour just people expressing what they valued, what they appreciated about her. And it's this constant opportunity for me to think, yeah, but I do that. Yeah, but I did that. I said something clever to you. Why are you saying so? She said such clever things. I said clever things too. I've said more clever things to you than she has. Yes. Yep. So conceit. Yeah, conceit. Yeah. We can take some solace in the fact that in the earliest sectors, the earliest strata of the Buddha's teaching, when he was... before we had the lists and the numbers and the stories and all of that, when he was in the Sutta-nipata, the chapter of the eights, which my scholarly friends who know a lot more about this than me would say, we can be fairly confident this is the earliest, this is definitely something he said. His major point is conceit. Yeah. The three conceits: I am better, I am equal, and I am worse. This is what we do. Again and again, time and time again, in so many different ways, we seek security, we seek identity. It is totally understandable. There is no... in a way, that's partly why I like this teaching, because for conceits, they're an operation for a desire for security, a desire for certainty. That is a completely human need. It is utterly understandable. Much better than kind of sin or impurity or any of those languages in that respect. But what the consequence of this is, that I experience myself as this little fragile kind of eggshell floating on the vast ocean of life. And it's scary, and I feel fragile, so I immediately enter into the game. Yeah, and the game is the score. The life is a competition. So for some of you who like this phrase, it's a zero-sum competition, but some of you don't. So if you like it, you can know what that means, and if you don't, you can not care. What it means is that only one person can win. Only one person can win. So who's winning? Is it me or is it Ken Madonna? Who's better at listening? You better give the right answer. Yes. So what we most value. So in a way, the big challenge here with what we most value is, can we separate that out from our own desire to win the game? Yeah, can we separate that out from our own desire to win the game? To what extent is whatever we value as an expression of our own fragility of consciousness, our own desire? So it's like, oh, well, I value people who are very welcoming and very friendly. But of course I value that because that's what I'm good at. The Buddha once asked his friends, he said to a whole bunch of them, what is the best quality for a person to have? Yeah? And surprise, surprise, they went around and they all said the quality they were best at. Yeah? And they were all enlightened. Yeah. So let's give ourselves a break with this sort of the dangers of conceit or the challenges of it. So what we most value it's human, isn't it? It's human to want to win. It is human to want to be secure. It is human to want to be loved, to be valued.
It's mind. It's not really human. It's just like conditioning.
That's a good question to ask in your group. Yeah. I could answer that, but you're going to... So carry on thinking about that, and maybe I'll say something which helps you decide what you think. Isn't it just mine? Well, I suppose an immediate response to that is that, well, the Buddhist tradition would identify what makes us human is an experience of mind. That is the defining feature of humanity. The defining quality of humanity is an experience of separate self-awareness. Doesn't mean to say that we can't go beyond that. And in that sense, you know, Buddhism is about becoming beyond human, superhuman. So the value of excellence. Yeah. So there's a competition. What we value. We value things which make us feel good, which makes us feel big. In some ways, what I'm doing here is questioning that valuing. But yet we have this inevitable valuing of excellence. I was thinking about it this morning when we were eating breakfast, and you know that thing Dara does when he's kind of crawling along and he kind of heads for the stairs. And I just had this moment where he was there and I couldn't see what was happening, and Prabhakara was standing watching him. And in my mind I start thinking, oh yeah, I feel quite critical of this driving for excellence, this wanting to be the best. I feel like that's not great. But then I also notice this kind of longing in me to see this little baby's head appear at the top of the stairs and him have climbed the stairs. Yeah, I feel this strong wish to see this little baby climb the stairs. What is that? Well, that's the desire for, the desire for excellence, you know, like the desire for achievement, aspiration, fulfillment, success. I was thinking about it. You might remember on Friday when we were going around, I was saying that I was enjoying watching Justin Timberlake videos at the moment. I was thinking, what is it about Justin Timberlake? And at his best, and often it's kind of derivative, kind of over-sexualized pap, but sometimes it's the joy of the capacity of the human body to move, the wonders of synchronization and kind of mastery. Yeah, Justin Timberlake is a master in some respects. So what about more spiritual qualities? Yeah, so the value of excellence. So I used to work for an order member called Subhuti, who's, I would argue, the second most influential Buddhist within Sri Ratna community. Doesn't mean to say that always that influence has been positive, and doesn't mean to say that everyone appreciates that influence. But I think it is kind of undeniable that he's had a profound shaping influence on this wider Sri Ratna Buddhist community. Yeah. I spent quite a few years living and working with him, and at the point when I came to stop working for him, I started thinking, well, what is it? What is it that I valued about him? What is it that he's exemplified? What are the qualities, as Kemi Daniel was asking us yesterday, what are the qualities which I most value about this person? So what's striking is Subhuti's written quite a lot of books. He's created institutions, he's built things, he's transformed things. He has taught Buddhism to literally thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. It's incredibly... Yeah, I could spend all of the rest of my time talking about all the things that I appreciate about Subhuti. But when I really thought about it, what it came down to, what I was strongly reminded of, were the words that Ananda, the Buddha's closest friend, said at the point of the Buddha's death. So it's an even more strong example. It's the Buddha, kind of the epitome of human excellence. And what Ananda wanted to say about him was, he who was so kind. He who was so kind. Not he who was so wise, or so vigorous, or so transformative, or so good at dancing. He who was so kind. So, you could present an argument that say, well, Dharmashala, you're a bit of a kind of like an emotional softie, so you would, that is what you would value about this person. And you could say the same thing of Ananda. You could say, well, Ananda's a bit of a wuss, really, isn't he? Come on, it's not really kindness. Actually, it's about wisdom or energy. So I was thinking of my very dear friend Vidya Ruchi, who is very different to me, it would be fair to say. And he knows Subhuti better than me. And I haven't asked him this. I'll ask him tomorrow, assuming that I see him when he arrives here before we leave. But I suspect my friend Vidya Ruchi, who in a certain sense values conceptual clarity more than any other single quality on this planet, I think if I asked him what he most values about Subhuti, I suspect he would say kindness too. I suspect. I need to ask him that. But I'm going to put it out there, but I think he's going to say, I value Subhuti's kindness. And particularly kindness in a particular context, that kindness which... it's the kindness which helps us grow. It's the kindness which takes us seriously. It's the kindness that sees the possibilities in us. Yeah. So it's not a kind of babyfying kindness. Well, it's the kindness of a good parent, a good mother or father, which brings that being into fuller beinghood. So what can we say about that? So my last little, in a way, was just a little thing for you to think about. So I'm suggesting that the most worthwhile qualities that are no rewards. The most worthwhile qualities that are no rewards. Yeah. So Justin Timberlake can receive a reward for his moves. Hussein Bolt can receive an award for how fast he can move his legs. But it doesn't. You don't get a gold medal for kindness. Yeah. You don't get a special recognition of the qualities of honesty. In some ways we do, don't you? You know, you have like the order of, like OBEs or kind of, Nobel Peace Prizes. So there's some truth in that. But compared to the amount of, I suppose you could say, compared to the amount of awards which are given for less kind of humanly valuable qualities, there's a mismatch there. Maybe you could say that. So the parable of the rain cloud. So today, officially, we're on Vairochana, who represents the sun, the vast sun. But I like the parable of the rain cloud, so let's have that instead. So the parable of the rain cloud, might rain today, is, and I think this is a sort of, well, again, I'm genuinely interested in other people experience this. For me, I think this is possibly one of the hardest teachings in Buddhism to actually experience rather than conceptually understand. So a parable of a rain cloud is very, very easy. So there's a vast plain of forest and plants and shrubs and grass and trees and all these different things. And a vast rain cloud, bearing in mind this is from ancient India when the rain is highly valued and anticipated, a rain cloud rolls over the scene and begins to rain. And it rains on everything. It rains on all plants equally. And all plants grow. And all plants reach their fullness in their own distinctive fashion. Everything flourishing, everything of value. So you might be thinking, what's so hard about that? So what I find effectively, conceptually impossible is to actually believe that the blade of grass is as valuable as the oak tree. Yeah, I have this kind of, this is what I have a question about with your experience as well. This is, and we're back to the competition thing. It's like my psyche is hardwired, strongly temperamentally inclined to think that the oak tree is more valuable than the blade of grass. And I find it very, very hard to really believe, because the teaching is definitely not saying that. The teaching is saying that the rain cloud, the rain falls on everything, and everything is of equal value. Yeah, and I find that almost utterly impossible to believe, to live by. But to my loss. So in a way, I'm not exactly saying any one thing in particular. In a way, I'm like evoking this kind of composite of different things. So there's the experience we have of competition, the desire for excellence, the valuing, the wanting to excel, the wanting to manifest qualities which other people think are good and worth having, and therefore for us to get points. Yeah. Conceit. Then we have this the valuing of kindness, much more profoundly than these other kind of sexier qualities. The suggestion that the most worthwhile qualities do we sufficiently value the most truly worthwhile qualities? And maybe that's some way of understanding something about this parable of the rain cloud. Well, maybe the grass kind of evokes, manifests a quality, a more human quality than the kind of striving oak tree. But there again, you see, I've already done it again. I'm already asserting, now I'm asserting that the grass is superior to the oak tree. So another question. Self-metta. What is the place of self-metta in our desire to grow? To what extent, or to put it more kind of pointedly, to what extent is any experience we have of a desire to grow predicated upon an absence of self-metta, like I'm not good enough, I need to be different, I need to be more, rather than an actual valuing of and flourishing and unfolding?
What does predicated mean?
Dependent upon, maybe.
So what's the question?
To what extent is our desire to grow dependent, coming out of and not being good enough right now, rather than a genuine flourishing and unfolding? So the reason I ask that is, bearing in mind we're all of different ages, I think it took me quite a few years of practicing Buddhism before I got to the point where desire for growth was manifested out of a genuine sense of flourishing rather than just not being good enough and wanting to be different from what I was so that people loved me more. Yeah. So I ask that as a bit of a question. In a way, as a bit of a caution, you know, yesterday and today, you know, we're kind of evoking these qualities. Yeah, Kenadana and myself were saying, well, yeah, there are these qualities, we can benefit people, we can exemplify. And that is important, but it's also really important to just notice to what extent is our lack of self-worth, our feeling that we're not good enough, we've got to be more, to what extent is that being imported in? And maybe what we need to do is really, with real gentleness and tenderness, examine those tendencies. So rolling on. So how about exemplification then? if you may remember, the start of the week, we had this phrase several times in that reading. The Buddha exemplifies or empathizes to connect. So what is the relationship between empathy and exemplification? And in a sense, most importantly, well, how does it bring people together? Well, So exemplification. What are we seeking to exemplify? So certainly the Buddhist tradition would say what we're seeking to exemplify are high spiritual qualities, as much as we're able to. Within Sri Ratna, we place a particular spin on that, and what we would say is primarily what we're seeking to exemplify is the process of growth, the process of unfoldment itself. So how is the process of growth, the process of unfoldment, how is that connected with empathy? How does it bring people together? So back to the spies. So the Buddha said, well, Your Majesty, it's hard to know if these crazy, aesthetic, ascetic, renunciant weirdos are real spiritual people. Because to know someone, to know the qualities of somebody's being, you have to see them. You have to see them at lots of times and lots of places. You have to see them happy. You have to see them sad. You have to see them when their phone is just broken down, when they're desperate to get on Facebook to update their status. Then you know. You have to see them when they don't get what they want. You have to see them lose it and see what they do after they've got really, really angry. That is how you know whether somebody's spiritual. So, of course, in some ways that brings us to Truvatna's greatest, one of Truvatna's greatest strengths is this emphasis on Sangha. So Sangha, as we conceive of it, which isn't true in all aspects of the Buddhist world, but I believe it's a better conception, Sangha, as we conceive of it, is being in genuine connection with each other, in genuine relationship with each other. Gulp. Yikes. So Brené Brown is, up until recently, she had the most viewed video on TED of all time, something past 20 million views. And her talk, her book, her kind of magnum opus, her thing, is simply entitled Daring Greatly, The Power of Vulnerability. And her primary message is what really inspires people, what really benefits people, what really exemplifies to people is revealing the messiness of our own psyches and being in process. Interestingly, at least at the point when she wrote the book about that, she said she's never watched this video. So there's 20 million people who have watched this video of her talking about being okay with being a mess. She can't bring herself to do it because it's too hard. Yeah? So that's interesting, isn't it? What does this mean for us? What does this mean for me? What does it mean for us as a Sangha? Well, in a way, the invitation is obvious, isn't it? It's like to exemplify empathy. And remember, empathy is, one traditional Buddhist word for it is anukampa, trembling with, vibrating with. And I think it's very easy for us to, for me, for us, for people, to sort of fall into a way into quite an adult child or parent child model with her. So here I am, the sorted person, you be messy, and I vibrate with you. Yeah? I think it's interesting to conceive of what it would be like for all of us if we shifted that a bit and we went for adult. Yeah. Okay, here you are and here I am, and we're both We're vibrating with each other. Yeah, empathy in both directions. We do okay at this. We do a lot better. Well, we've got this built into our conception of what it is to be a Sangha, what it is to be an order member, what it is to not be an order member. We've got it built in, but I would suggest that we could help all of us help each other by taking a few more risks in this department, being a bit more vulnerable in this department. What would it be to really meet each other rather than relying on roles? Yeah. So when I was thinking about this earlier, one of the most obvious examples for me would be meditation. Yeah, like meditation is not one of my strongest suits, to say the least. And what I find interesting is the ease with which, when I start talking about meditation with some or any of you, I it, the ease with which I sort of, I hear about what's going on for you in meditation and sort of leave an unspecified gap with what's going on with me, which sort of assumes, implies that I'm doing better than you, yeah? It's definitely not the case. That is definitely not a given. With some of you, I'm pretty, I'm almost completely confident that that is not the case. So what would it be to really meet a bit more in that context? To not kind of rely on roles, not rely on projection, to use that word. So where I need to grow, more than anything else, where you can all help me, is my the degree to which laziness is embedded in my consciousness. So I was just thinking about this last night when I was thinking about this ago. The way in which laziness kind of manifests in all these different ways in my experience. So one of the most obvious ones is, well, the laziness in regards to effort in meditation, the laziness in responding, the laziness and sort of immediacy. I'm a very kind of immediate moment orientated person, to my fault, I think. Sometimes that has advantages. So it means, for example, if you come and say to me, Dharmashalan, can I talk to you? I will almost always say yes and not do the thing which I should arguably be needing to do more, because I get more value, I get more self-identity from being friendly and accessible. But that is not to necessarily to my benefit, and it's not necessarily to our benefit as a sangha in its entirety. Yeah, because it means I don't finish my projects, or I don't move through projects as quickly as I could, because I'm always prioritising other people. That is a manifestation of laziness. There's a positive quality as well, of course. This is a big one. You can delight-challenge your order member friends by asking them about this. What do you do with pleasure? Yeah. What do you do for fun? Yeah. That's what the Buddha would have said. The Buddha would have said, is this person spiritual? What do they do for fun? What do they do with their spare time? Very, very interesting question. I like playing games, and I've spent the last 17 years of my Buddhist life trying to work out what to do with that propensity to enjoy, the fact that I enjoy playing games, shame, guilt, concealment, for sort of like, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. All of these different moves, it's like, I'm sick of it, I'm tired of it. Here's another little question for you, nearly finished. Would it be better if I was awakened? Yeah? Would it actually be better if I was enlightened? ? Yeah, it's funny saying that, or saying that bit about laziness, in some ways I wanted it to have more weight. And that doesn't, I don't quite know how I can do that. But it's sort of like this, I want to grow. And I suppose I deeply believe that the most efficient way of human beings growing is through relationship to other people. So it's like, okay, what would that even look like? Rather than sort of inhibiting that with kind of stories and presentations and role, to actually just like, oh look, here we are. What do we do? How do we deal with this? Anyway, just to acknowledge that. Spiritually naked, but not physically. So if you go to the Buddha Field Festival, one of the things you will notice more and more as the time goes on is people being naked, yeah? And as I've never really talked to them about it, but I'm pretty confident that they think they're doing something spiritual, yeah? Pretty confident. And I think it goes something along the lines of, I am open, here I am. Wiggle, 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 wiggle. Yeah. Not entirely tasteful, frankly. Yeah. Well, Buddhist people and not Buddhist people. So the question here, of course, is one of appropriateness. What is it? So here I am saying, let's be really naked with each other. How to do that appropriately, that's a journey, and it's easy to stuff that up. But there's a few obvious observations. One of them is, like this question of appropriateness, spiritually, not physically. To put it another way, I was talking to a good friend who's into the kind of conscious sexuality, which basically means sleeping around. And one of the questions I asked him, I said, So are all the people you do this with highly attractive? And he looked a bit kind of embarrassed. He said, yes. I said, well, therefore, it's not really open, is it, actually? You know, like, if it was really open, then your physical looks wouldn't be what's important here. But actually, it's just about kind of hot people having more sex, which, like, you know, fine if you're hot and you want to have lots of sex, fair enough, but let's not over-dignify it by making that spiritual. Anyway, little dig. So probably more importantly is the question of the challenge of negative mental states. Yeah, the challenge of negative mental states. So if we are going to be more open, more vulnerable, more honest with each other, an inevitable consequence of that is that we see each other angry, upset, in a bad mood, going rah. What do we do with that? Yeah, I don't have an answer. I simply present it as a question. Well, I have a couple of answers. One of them is, again, thinking of my dear friend Subhuti, who I think is one of the most impressive human beings I've ever met. He has definitely got a propensity to anger. And he really liked this saying of Winston Churchill's, no man is a hero to his valet. No man is a hero to his valet. The implication of that being like Winston Churchill was a substantial drunkard, and his valet was as well. And they used to get into, you know, they used to get into rolling fist fights and things like that. But in some ways, I suppose what I want—I don't know very much about Winston Churchill—but what I see in Subhuti is a capacity to not. Or to acknowledge, to apologise, to take responsibility for. So that's all we've got, isn't it? We will all experience negative mental states. We all get angry, aggressive, upset, greedy, hurt, sad. Can we acknowledge that? Can we take responsibility? That's all we've got. But that, I believe, is an incredibly powerful practice. The other thing we can do is... practice individuality. It is a real challenge being around people you respect and look up to, who when they say things you don't agree with, let alone be in a bad mood and be grumpy. Yeah, that is a real challenge to our individuality. And I think there's a real opportunity for growth there. Yeah, but it's an uncomfortable one. So I remember having, not so long ago, snapping at one of my friends, and I felt... I just felt like a lot of full kind of shame, actually. That was unacceptable. Like, it was very, you have to contextualise, it was a very kind of minor snap. But nonetheless, I felt a lot of shame about that. And I suppose what I found really interesting in it was this fear that this is sort of somehow destroyed all of the positivity in our relationship, all of the good in our relationship, and it's just been cut in that one moment. Well, in some ways, it has to not be that way, because we're all going to screw up and we're all going to get angry and we're all going to get grumpy. But what can we do? What can I do in relation... You know, it goes all ways. So what can I do, to the extent to which you, any or all of you, any of you look up to me, what can I do to be better at acknowledging and apologising for when I act like that? And what can I do in relation to those to whom I look up to... or take responsibility. Yeah. That's the power of the Sangha. The power of the Sangha is to really, I suppose this is what I'm deeply convinced of, the power of the Sangha is the unbelievable vast potential for transformation in the field of human relationships. Let's activate that more. And that is exemplification of empathy. So just a final few words and then a few questions. So exemplification. When we were divvying up these themes, I immediately wanted exemplification because I love Superman. Superman exemplifies, doesn't he? I haven't talked about that, so that's a first superhero reference. There you go. But really, again, I just come back to this thing, well, what is really... for richness of human lives, for values that are most important. Again, so having done that thing about the blade of grass and the oak tree, I'm going to come back to kind of asserting a primacy of values, which I don't think stands, but I'm going to do it anyway. So the richness of human lives. Well, I suppose what stands out for me are three qualities: kindness, courage, and openness. Yeah. Kindness, courage, and openness. I think everyone values those qualities. I think nobody can deny that if there were more of those qualities in the world, it would be a good thing, irrespective of where you come on the scorecard. Even if you're like 7 billionth in the human race, having kindness, courage, and openness is a good thing. Yeah, for us and for other people. Yeah. But also, back with a blade of grass, sometimes it's really, 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 really hard to say. Yeah. Because part of the message of Buddhism is that it's not about where you are on the graph. It's about the momentum. It's about the momentum. So I remember Sangharuchi telling me this little story from a class back at the Buddhist Center recently, where at the end of the night there was this really like archetypal, there was this really kind of quiet little mousy guy, this little quiet mousy Asian guy, as it happens. And Sangharuchi was like, whatever, not interesting, not important, kind of, who are you? And then, because Sangharuchi is able to acknowledge and recognize the superficiality of those kinds of thoughts, because he practices openness, kindness, and courage, he went and talked to a guy and said, oh, who are you? Yeah. So it turns out this guy, he's a 17-year-old kid from Coventry. He caught 2 buses to come to the Buddhist Center. His parents are devout Muslims, and he, with no aggression, no argument, can come to the conclusion that Islam is not the religion he chooses to follow. He does not seek to kind of get into combat with his devout family. He's just like, no, I can see you like it. It's not for me. I'm going to go and explore something else. Yeah. I'm not sure if I would have the courage to do that now, let alone from when I was 17. So the questions, comparison, conceit, when do we do it, how do we do it? The blade of grass versus the oak tree, ? Spiritually naked, love it, loathe it. And what qualities do we value? The richness of human lives. What qualities do we value in ourselves and in others? Maybe more so than in others.